So just an overview of today. I am in conversation with a number of you who did the overnight work, and thank you. We will be taking that into account and processing it to a certain extent, but I'm also aware of some of you who decided the better thing to do would be to take a walk, and I want to support that too. So we'll be doing some processing of it. We'll be doing a little bit of work in so that some of you might do 3 or 4 minutes of the overnight work right now. Then the latter part, since you, many of you I know have read the whole of The Thunder Perfect Mind, then we'll alternate between things I think you might want to know and things that you think you want to know, back and forth. So this is the second session on The Thunder Perfect Mind. For those of you who are new, or at least didn't come yesterday, I apologize. We'll try to act as if that's not the case, and stay faithful to both constituencies. Tomorrow, we'll be continuing our larger picture of a vulnerable God, and we'll look at actually the text that I did first word on this morning, The Secret Revelation of John. And then Friday we will return to the Gospel of Mark, and so we will have 3 texts before us in the Gospel of Mark as we sort out what is useful about this kind of picture of God and us. So, just a brief, let me check in. How many of you were not here yesterday? Very important. Thank you. That's at least 15 of you. So what I'm going to do now is simply have a reading of an excerpt from The Thunder Perfect Mind. And I'm wondering if, as I just finish off this, if two women would consider reading this, not together, but one page and the other. So, just briefly, for those of you who weren't here, The Thunder Perfect Mind is, and folks coming in, their handouts down here, you can grab them and not disturb us. So, The Thunder Perfect Mind is from this major collection found in 1945 near the village of Nag Hammadi in Egypt, central Egypt, and it found in a jar by peasants, and it contained, they thought it would contain, as they decided hesitantly to break open the jar, they decided that it might contain some of Pharaoh's lost treasures, and they were disappointed that there were only 52 books. And they dragged that home to their courtyard, left it in the courtyard for at least a year. Their mother, when it was cold part of the year, said, go get some of that papyrus in the jar and start a fire, and they did. So great story. That's only little bits of that. So this is The Thunder Perfect Mind. It's one of those 52. It's probably either the first or second most popular in public. The other very popular is the Gospel of Thomas, which was also discovered for the first time in that jar. This is a, just in terms of, especially those who weren't here yet, this is a speech by a divine, mostly female, a little queer voice. And we've talked about that at some length. It's a common way it's a common piece of literature that is that gods and goddesses speak in long speeches in the ancient world about how great they are, is simply kind of a dime a dozen. This is really different in a couple of ways, in that almost, well, really all of the revealing speeches of gods and goddesses in the ancient world say the voice is, I am great, I am good, I am beautiful, I am powerful. And Thunder, one difference between that and Thunder's voice is Thunder says she is powerful and fairly good, but she's not all powerful and she's wounded. Okay, I saw a hand back there then.
Yes, could you remind us how this book gets its title?
I avoided that and thought I would just confuse you. I thank you for that. I apologize for not doing it yesterday. We have no clue. Of the four words, the four Coptic words, the thunder, colon, perfect mind, only one of those words even occurs in the text, the word mind.
And that have this a title, or is this what scholars?
No, this is right in the top. Is the top line of the manuscript itself, the only manuscript we have. But here's the basic answer: is ancient authors don't like titles. So in contrast to we modern writers, the ancients neither like to have a title, nor like to have their name on their book. And so what happens is that, in terms of the title, is it's the copyists two or three generations later who put the titles on. So just remember, this is not just about Thunder, this is about the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, etc. No titles. The earlier the manuscripts, the less access we have to titles. So that's kind of an answer, non-answer, right? It's just the copyist. And so last week we were studying the Odes of Solomon, which is a first century set of songs involving Jesus. And Solomon is 1,000 years away. But a copyist thought it was about Solomon.
So is yes. This dated of all of the 52 dated to the first century?
No, some should be dated to the second as well, and I would say a few even into the third century. So most of us these days in New Testament date the latest book in the New Testament to be Second Peter in the second half of the second century. So it's we don't know when Thunder was written at all. It's just too new for us to know. When I'm forced to give a date, I would say middle to late second century. All right. So are there two women who would be willing to read the excerpt? Paula and Michelle. Paula, would you start out, and Michelle, you take the second. And those of you who don't have this is there is a handout for those of you who didn't get it, but you can get it on the way. This is just about 20% of the text.
I was sent out from power. I came to those.
Oh, excuse me.
Wait, where do you want?
Where am I?
Just the excerpt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the reading the other one would take the whole hour.
I was going to say. All right. Forgive me.
That's right. Do not do
the first site.
It's the one that's like the
first. Oh, the one you did it. I got that one. I'm sorry. Sorry, y'all. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground.
Can I now interrupt you and ask you to be a little louder?
Of course. Okay. How far do you want me to read? Help.
No, you read the first half, the first page, and Michelle reads the second.
Got it. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms. Do not stare at me when I am thrown out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among the slaughtered viciously. In my weakness, do not strip me bare. I was sent out from power. I came to those pondering me. Look at me, all you who contemplate me. Audience, hear me. Be careful. Do not ignore me. I am the first and the last. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I am he, the mother, and the daughter. I am the limbs of my mother. I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. I am she whose wedding is extravagant, and I didn't have a husband. I am the midwife, and she who hasn't given birth.
I am the comfort of my labor pains. I am the bride and the bridegroom. And it is my husband who gave birth to me. I am the silence never found, and the idea infinitely recalled. I am the voice with countless sounds, and the thousand guises of the word. I am the speaking of my name. I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling whole boldness. When then did you hate me, you Greeks? Why then did you hate me, you Greeks? Because I am a barbarian among barbarians. And I am the wisdom of the Greeks and the knowledge of the barbarians. I am the deliberation of both the Greeks and barbarians. I am he whose image is multiple in Egypt, and she who is without an image among the barbarians. Receive me with understanding and heartache. Take me from the discarded and crushed places. Advance toward childhood. Do not hate it because it is small and insignificant. Don't reject the small parts of greatness because they are small. Since smallness is recognized from within greatness, I am a foreigner and a citizen of the city.
Thank you so much, both of you. So I'm going to there with that stop the brief summary of yesterday, next we'll do a little bit of processing of this text as a whole and in excerpts through the spiritual exercise that some of you did last night. Just to say that I am not expecting people to read their assignment out loud. Indeed, as we saw how Thunder talks about herself, it's intimate, often in pain, as well as powerful. And I assume that some of what some of you wrote in your spiritual exercises is too private for you. In other words, I almost want to say if your spiritual exercise could be made completely public, you may not have done it as well as you could. So there, in the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to ask us to hear anyone who wants to say phrases from their assignment or from their spiritual exercise, but not the whole thing. And right now, just for those of us joining for the first time, the idea here is that since Thunder's voice is clearly divine and clearly wounded, and not always all powerful, although quite powerful, and references so clearly human experience as a part of who she is divinely. Because of that, I suggested that we all might write our own I Am, and take a clue from Thunder to write the parts of us that are not necessarily coherent, that are sometimes in contradiction with our own selves, that say things that we aren't necessarily proud of, but are deeply a part of us. Talk about our woundedness. Talk about our power. So that was the assignment. So given that, I think what I'd like to do, first of all, is for those of you gathering now, let's just take, whether you've done this or not, let's take about 4 or 5 minutes to write a little bit of I Am. So write down I Am. You can write it on your paper. If you don't have anything to write on, I would got to give you pencil. Or just think about some I Am statements for yourself. Take Thunder as the model, but take yourself as the person. Questions about this brief review of the spiritual exercise? Thank you. I'll call you when, I'll tell you when we're a minute away from coming back together. It'll be about 4 minutes. Now I'm going to ask us to come halfway back toward one another. Let's stay in a time of silence. And then if anyone wants to say a phrase or a sentence from your I Am, or two, if you'd like, will be, I suggest that we work on being comfortable with the silence in between the I Ams. Just staying within your I Am, waiting for a larger I Am as it emerges. Inasmuch as you can say it loudly, that would help us. If you can't, if you're working at just getting the words out, that's okay too. So let's be in silence. We'll go for a while. I'll let us know when we're near a time to come back together. I am different than my father. Oh no, I am also the same.
I am the slave and the tyrant.
I am secretive and open.
I am the liar and the truth teller.
I am venturesome and timid.
I am strong, but sometimes intimidated. I am stubborn, but I am submissive.
I am drunk without drinking.
I am clearly seen and heard, but I am a mystery to you.
I am hopeful, but I am concerned.
I need to be in control of my surroundings, but I hate to be controlled.
I am changing.
I am a leader, and I am a follower.
I am believing and doubting to the point of unbelief.
I am little mind, and I am big mind.
I am both empathy and competitive.
I am haunted by the stars in the dark night.
I am a duality in my being.
I am faithful, but uncertain.
I am invisible and vivid.
I am a mirror, and I am a sponge.
Let's take another minute, another last couple of statements.
I can read and write, but I cannot learn.
I speak out, I am silent. I act, I wait.
I am a peacemaker who's not always peaceful.
I need to be left alone, and I'm a people person.
I am joyful, I am despairing.
I despair and lose confidence. I persist and fight for my joy.
Let's take another minute in silence. Take what has been spoken and unspoken into your heart. Thank you. Just a couple of moments then, if you want to step just another piece away from this spiritual exercise. Any reflections that you want to have out loud on what this was like for you. This is an exercise that I've done really in hundreds of groups, and so I know that for some this might be not only difficult but insulting, and some for breakthroughs and discoveries. Any comments that would help you to say out loud about your process?
I found it really integrating for me because it allowed me to really reflect on and accept the wholeness of who I am, the whole spectrum.
Thank you.
I had trouble with it because in my mind, I had to compartmentalize my life in different eras because I am not today who I was even 5 years ago. I'm profoundly different.
Mm.
So I ended up writing a one paragraph autobiography of my own. As a child, as now an old man. And I couldn't do it in the singular temporal unit.
Yeah, great point.
This has been beautifully profound. Experiences, what we just did.
Do you know, I actually thought I was the only person who had these opposite feelings, like there was something wrong with me because, it's hard to explain, but you think that, oh my gosh, I'm the only one who feels like this. How am I going to solve this problem? But it's a human condition, obviously, that it just was such an epiphany to have these dual feelings about things.
Mm.
I wonder about making it a spiritual discipline that you would engage on a regular basis.
Yes. Yeah. So I found many people kind of just living in thunder and around the edges and doing that regularly, yes.
I noticed that I was putting the good thing first and the bad thing second. I was wondering if I was trying to build myself up that way.
Oh, that's quite revealing. Thanks for that.
Yeah. I found it liberating, I think, because the text is the divine and vulnerable, made me brave in looking at my whole. So it's like permission to be all these things.
Yeah.
Even though we had to search ourselves, I got the feeling that other people knew this about us already.
Oh, that's really another level of the exercise. Maybe we could ask people who know us to write RIS. Yes, up there.
I like the word permission, and that's kind of one of the things that I felt when I was thinking about it for myself. But then I also found that if I spent some more time thinking about it, it allowed me to see other people in a more complex way, so that they didn't have to be just one thing. And like, you don't have to just say, oh, that contradicts the thing that you said you were before, but then they were allowed to have that complexity as well.
Oh, what a beautiful expansion relationally of the exercise. Thank you. Well, thank you. Again, my experience is that that this is indeed a possible element of one's own ongoing spiritual practice. So, backing then into some of the more heady things we talked about yesterday, and taking advantage that a number of you had were able to read the whole text, not just the excerpts that we had. So I'd like to. I'm going to identify a few minutes of conversation for me about some of the larger issues that I've been noticing in the text, and then we'll take one person who will ask a question or make a statement that they've been working on overnight that we'll talk about together, and we'll alternate in that way. I think the first thing I want to have us bring to more consciousness is the connection between divinity and humanity. Yesterday we mostly talked explicitly about getting this on the divine spectrum because it was so different, so vulnerable, and so incomplete. But overnight, this exercise was meant to celebrate the fact that humanity is so powerfully in the text as well. We noted yesterday especially, it's the ways that societies box in women's self-understanding, and this tries to break open that kind of humanity. And so I want to suggest that one of the unfolding learnings here is to integrate divinity and humanity. One of the great, shall we say, contributions to Christian doctrine is to separate them, to emphasize how God is above and beyond humanity in so many ways, and how human, and to emphasize the experience of humanity's sinfulness. Here I would note that this is a very strong integration of divinity and humanity, and I would suggest not necessarily on the model of incarnation. So in other words, we within the Christian conversation think about humanity and divinity on the model of God became human. Within our tradition, there's a larger one in which God's creation is an overflowing of God's self. But here you have an interestingly jagged, unprepared, and surprising mix of divinity and humanity. From my point of view, as I've worked on myself spiritually and what this text has brought me, for me the insideness has been important. That is, me really thinking about myself as inside God. So we're better at thinking about God inside us. But it seems to me that this text clearly entertains us being a part of God's being. I think that that suggestion in some quarters is heretical. And there may be reasons not to think that way, but it feels to me as if really letting oneself be a part of God is different than being God, and is the same. So that's one of the major spiritual challenges and gifts of this piece. Any comments, protests, thoughts on that?
I think that for me, it maybe is easier to think of it as you look at others.
As
you look at others.
Uh-huh.
Because I think of Christ's comments about seeing himself in the poor, and that to me is maybe absent to it.
Yeah.
To say that this person is in God, is in truth.
So looking at that, not in terms of one's own I am, but in terms of others.
Yeah.
I thought one of the most profound and helpful statements yesterday, I don't know who made the statement, was that this sounds like church, mm-hmm. especially the early church.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right, let's now expand a little bit your voices, so not necessarily on what I just said, but some of you have read this overnight, didn't get a chance to speak last time. What is an important understanding or question that one of you would have? Raise your hand and I'll call on you. Jay.
So, where is God when it hurts?
Where is God when? When you hurt?
Yeah, when you hurt.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think you weren't here yesterday, but this is really at the heart of this voice. Because as you may have heard when Paula was reading, so listen to her first speaking. Don't be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile. Do not stare at me when I am thrown out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously. In my weakness, do not strip me bare. So I want to say, this is a God who experiences those things and actually is fighting against them and that having happened to her. So my first answer on that would be, actually, I think that this is one of the only divine expressions that I know that is so vulnerable that she herself has experienced and is experiencing the pain that you were asking about. So that, is that near your question, Jay?
Yeah.
So in other words, this is at least heterodox. It's a different way of thinking about God. And since you so pointedly and importantly asked that, I would just note that by and large, especially for Christian thinkers about God, something during the 20th century and on into our time happened when 6 million Jews were killed. This is just an example, but it was the example that put us over the top in thinking that God could be all-powerful and all-loving. Because that, I think, I hear in your question, what is one of the biggest questions about God now in our time is that, in other words, a God who would be all-powerful and all-loving and at the same time 6 million people would be murdered. It's hard for us to think that that God isn't also cruel and not someone one would want to relate to.
Along that line, I find anger. Is there anger in some of those statements?
Yeah, she is mad in some of them. And sometimes she's mad when she's in control, and sometimes she's mad when she's being hurt. All right. Back there, and then I'll take one too.
What I was thinking of is the difference between the New Testament and the Old Testament. The Old Testament defines a cruel God who controls people thoroughly. The New Testament defines a loving God. Mm. So there's a dichotomy between the two.
Yeah, thank you. That does help some people. Frankly, I think that's a disservice to Judaism. Some of the most loving stuff is in the Hebrew Scriptures. And as far as I can tell, in the whole Christian Bible, the most violent and cruel is the Revelation to John. I mean, it also has important messages, but there, God slaughters thousands. I did my thesis on my dissertation on the Revelation of John and think it has much value. But for me, it's when we Christians, not all of you are Christians, thank you, divide it that way, it feels like we lose some resources from the Hebrew Scriptures and we forget about some of the hard-nosed stuff in the New Testament. I apologize for my disagreement with you. I'm going to say another thing or two. So one of the historical questions about thunder is, how was this written, and when was it read? I've told us in the last 2 days several times, so the ancient readers, so there are only 5 to 10% of the Mediterranean population that can read and write. And that means that reading and writing is always a public event. In other words, in the ancient world, when someone's learning to read, they learn to read out loud because they know that it is for everybody. What they are learning has to be a part of everybody's identity. In other words, they will always be reading to someone. So I'm pretty sure that this is not something that someone walks into a corner with and spends private time with, because that's just not what the ancients did. One of the main things many of us are working on is whether this itself is an ongoing performance. You might say worship, you might say theater, but if you say theater, it would be inclusive theater. So in other words, a number of us are thinking really strongly that every time the thunder is read, it's different. Because the invitation that was yours today was there. It feels to me like the more I stay with the individual elements of the text, the more I can see that might be changed the next time by someone or added to. That this is a very alive text. And if we had more than one version of it, which we don't, they would all be different And that would be really, really good. So that's the, as I've said, I'm probably wrong about that. But that's about as far as we're getting. In the book that I co-wrote about Thunder, I did have a chapter on performance of, in this regard. We just don't have enough scholars working on it to see how wrong I am. Another comment or question? Dan.
I just wanted to follow that up because I find that just a really helpful and kind of freeing reminder. For me, teaching at the university and stuff, I'm part of a culture that puts so much authority on final written products.
Yeah.
And it means we examine every comma and semicolon and capitalization at that, and forget that these were vehicles for, like you say, for performance. And so when I have my students to read oral traditions, or we'll read Black Elk Speaks, or read Lakota tradition, and to remind ourselves, because it's really easy to get hung up again on all the actual words as final product, and that misses so much of the richness of these were fluid and performing, and there was something else going on, very relational that way. So I really appreciate you reminding us about that, because I find myself falling back into that kind of scholarly, examine every letter mode.
Yeah, and that reminds me of what Mike was saying about your own reading, that it felt like it was too inhibiting. Once it was down on paper. And again, then we have the larger phenomenon of the Bible itself, who is a collection of living documents frozen. So for me, it's odd that so many documents that are in process, in the writing of them, for instance, Mark is almost certainly the first gospel. Matthew and Luke decided, I'll take that and I'll change it. And then it gets frozen. Yeah?
The fact that it's titled The Thunder leads credence to the audio portion, that it is a presentation, as opposed to it being titled Lightning, which may be more the written component to it.
Yeah, well, that makes progress on my fact that my suggestion that it's just nothing. That's great.
You know what I'm totally impressed with is that this is so feminine, that if a woman was performing this, that she didn't get stoned.
Right. And just to say a little bit more about that historically, if I may. First of all, because the reading of the New Testament is a silencing for many women. I want to say not because that's actually the historical fact in the New Testament. It's the dominant reading of it. But yes, this opens up the possibility. And one of the things we know is that from about the middle of the first century BCE to about the end of the second century, not just for Christ movements, but for the Mediterranean in general, was a giant advance in women's voices. So, in other words, women got the right to divorce. Women got the right to have property. Women got the rights to be in public in different ways during that period. We don't quite know why, and we do know that eventually in the third century there was new clamping down on it. So I want to say that makes Thunder a part of a larger phenomenon that is flowering within that 200 plus years. Another, please. Yes, Rick. Great, we've got Barbara.
Well, I just am reacting to your word frozen, that the Bible itself is a collection of living documents that got frozen. I think your own work in the book in the beginning was the meal, which is my favorite, has shown, in fact, that's not the case, that the way the New Testament came into being was around meals. It was around this performance aspect. So I guess just to say, we don't have to just go to Thunder Perfect Mind to have this, to see this dynamic creative process of oral performance being central. And in fact, that in a meal kind of setting, that people telling stories was a living tradition, not a frozen.
Thank you so much. It's, you know, one of the things, Dan, you were saying about getting the book finally right, we forget what we wrote ourselves. No, but actually, you're right. The frozenness for me happens in canonicity, not in the production, the flowering. Yes, all of those are stunningly in process. And as you pointed out, you and I really undergird how much the worship service, which were these meals for the first 200 years, were in process all the time.
And you want to say a little bit more? I guess I'd say the very fact, I don't view canonicity maybe as negatively as it sounds like perhaps you do, although I'm not sure, but the very fact that the canon preserves four different versions of the same story is so helpful because it shows the fluidity. So like in Matthew's gospel, it's two blind men who are healed, whereas in Mark, it's Bartimaeus. And same thing with stories about women. And the different versions can help us realize these are oral traditions, these are oral texts, and there's multiple versions in circulation until very late, and all of them have a living tradition.
Yeah, that's, I quote Irenaeus on that front so much. I don't like Irenaeus a lot, but he has got this great idea. He's the first one who says, let's have four Gospels. And the reason is...
I love the contradictions.
Yeah. I mean, the reason he says is that there are four winds that blow and four corners of the earth. In other words, he's saying, let's have four Gospels so it will be diverse. And yeah, it depends on what side of the bed I wake up on in terms of how I feel about canonicity. Let's have another person say what's cooking for them. Yes?
I apologize, I wasn't here on your Tuesday, so this is just kind of a very basic question. But so this book, so Gospel of Thomas was in the jar and some other things. It's easy to assume that the Gospel of Thomas, since Thomas was a disciple, was part of the Jesus movement, came out of Jesus movement. So are we assuming that this is coming out of same thing? How does it fit in there? I'm sorry if I'm trying to compartmentalize.
No, you're reminding me of something I said I would say today and didn't. That's so great. It's in what I call the Jesus jar. So it probably is related to early Christian folks. And yesterday we were actively flirting with the fact that this was Jesus or is Jesus.
Well, this is what I wonder because even though there are very different words that are, but certainly Jesus, you know, suffering on the cross could be considered a shit pile.
Yeah,
so there is suffering. I mean, some of this is...
Yeah, on Monday we looked at the Gospel of Mark and found that all over the place. It's not just on the cross, but throughout Mark, Jesus is unsteady as well as brilliant. Jesus is hurt as well as in control. So yes, exactly. And that helps me say the larger piece is, from my point of view, the one of the main reasons that thunder is in the jar is because Jesus's divinity, it's not Jesus's humanity, it's Jesus's divinity and humanity that are unstable, imperfect, not all-powerful. And so I want to claim more and more the articulations in the first two centuries about Jesus as a figure like thunder. And I think actually probably their logic goes the opposite way around. they know Jesus as unstable, a vulnerable, powerful, and hurt at the same time. And when they, whether Thunder was written by a Christ person, a Christ movement person, or they just stuck it in their jar because they like it so much, I have no clue. We may know in the next 20 years as we get some more work on it. Thank you so much for getting me out where I should be. Let me see if there's something that... let me talk a little bit about queerness, if I may, because there's a fair amount of scholarship cooking on that front. As I said yesterday, when we came out with our book on Thunder, one of my best friends, Karen King at Harvard, and I had this huge argument because we had found in the Coptic 6 different times in which the I am is associated with a he. And the previous generation of translations all simply ignore that and say, no, this has got to be a she all the way through. And so I and my colleagues in that translation and book, we decided that feels like earlier gender thinking that we, that is not as current as some others, that is that gender can be complexly a mix of identity. And since Thunder's voice is so powerful in deconstructing the corners that women are painted into in what they're called, why wouldn't this be also a deconstructive project? So it really does say in the Coptic, I am he, the mother. And I've been a stay-at-home dad for a long time. I'm not saying I'm all female, but I'm saying that there was a shared reality for those years that was very humbling and helpful to me to see how much my masculinity got in the way of all kinds of learning and identity. This is primarily a female figure, and that in and of itself is wonderfully disconcerting in the ancient and modern world. But I would say that doesn't rule out a queer mix of ongoing gender development in humanity. I'd love some in the 30 seconds that I've given you to respond. response, Dan?
Just a quick question, since I don't know Coptic at all. How similar or different are he and she in Coptic? So that would it be one missing stroke? So it could be a tribal error. Are these pretty distinctively different words?
No, they're associated words, but they're different, and they're really intentionally different words. There's the whole. Karen and I had like a 3-hour argument about this, and went to the math and both of us thought we won. What we haven't gotten to and won't get to, we might do a little bit of this. So that other handout that I have is the kind of the elephant in the room. How did the New Testament, traditional New Testament, come into being? I've given you a page out of a New Testament in which it takes into the late 400s and shows that there's still not clarity on that. The first all church council that declared what was in the New Testament was in the 16th century. There are some regional councils that do that in the 4th century, but no all church councils. So take a look at that, and we might be able to refer to it in the next 2 days. Thanks so much.